Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 31st, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing the NLRB's just-announced rule on joint employers. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome as our expert Mr. Michael J. Letito. He's co-chairman of the Workplace Policy Institute and a shareholder in the Littler Mendelson Law Firm. He's going to give us some opening remarks describing the rule and some other things, some of its implications. He'll speak initially for about 5 to 8 minutes or so, but then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that part of the program. But for now, Mr. Letito, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Dean, and hello, everybody. Thanks for joining the call. What I thought I might do is begin by talking a little bit about why has the Labor Board done what they've done. What have they done and how have they done it? How does this threaten the employer-employer relationship or the B2B relationship? Just mention some practical problems that we can dig into later on. And then the question that we're being overwhelmed with is, what do we do next? And unfortunately, I've got a lot of information on my first question. So what do you do next is a much more difficult one. And as Dean said, I'll try to limit this to about 5 minutes or so. Why has the Labor Board done what they've done? And for those that don't practice in the area, the Labor Board sits in Washington, D.C., 5 people, nominated by the President, approved by the Senate. And if you've got a D in the White House, it goes 3-2-D. If you've got an R in the White House, it goes 3-2-R. So this is a democratically controlled labor board consistent with the provisions of the statute that has been issuing very pro-employee, very pro-union decisions for some period of time, including the quickie election rule, as well as specialty health care, which makes for smaller bargaining units. So from that perspective, this decision is not a surprise. In the broader social context, and it's important because the dissent and the decision really focuses in on the fact that what the board is trying to do is to address social issues outside the parameters of what they should be able to do, consistent with their statutory obligations, rights, and interpretations. There's been a lot of discussion about income inequality, the fight for 15, especially against quick service restaurants and the franchise industry, has received a tremendous amount of publicity. And there's been a book written by David Weil, who is the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor, called The Fissured Workplace, that was published in 2014. And the theory behind this, and I think that that's the intellectual Bible between for a lot of what's going on here, is that employers are organizing themselves in different kinds of business arrangements in order to avoid liability and responsibility for the employees who, while they may not employ them, actually, quote-unquote, control them. And what this decision does is to give unions an opportunity to force that, quote-unquote, responsible employer, the secondary employer as opposed to the direct employer of the employees, the obligation to sit down at the table and bargain. And I think that the philosophy is such that since, quote-unquote, we need more unions in order to lower the income inequality, and unionization is at 6.5% of the private sector, by giving unions this greater opportunity to bargain with the, quote-unquote, real employer, that will narrow this income inequality. And that's why we've established the joint employer relationship, because the little guy is not going to be able to say, I can't afford it anymore, because the big guy is going to be sitting at the table. I think that was the philosophy behind the decision and what motivated the 3 members of the board, the majority of the board, to issue the rule as they did. So this case, Browning-Ferris, which is a representation case, which means it's all about what an appropriate bargaining unit is, has been sitting around for a couple of years, and it's somewhat unusual, and I give the board credit for the fact that it asked for amicus briefs in the case, and it specifically posed a number of questions that it wanted the amici to respond to, including whether or not the board should abandon its current joint employer test and move into a different direction, and if so, why, and what should that direction be. And there were a tremendous number of amicus briefs that were filed, both going for and against maintaining the current rule and expanding it. So I give the board credit for at least telling interested parties what they intended to do. And as I said, a lot of groups like the International Franchise Association chimed in, including the General Counsel of the Labor Board, who chimed in here with an amicus brief of his own, urging the Labor Board to abandon the current rule and to go down a different path. The General Counsel, again, for those that don't practice in the area, he's independent of the Board of the Judges, the General Counsel is the Chief Prosecutor, so that was an important amicus brief. So in the decision, which is about 50 pages, and if you want to summarize it, take a look at the lead editorial from Saturday's Wall Street Journal, because I think they did a good job in discussing it. There's commentary on TV. I mean, you can't pick up a newspaper without seeing somebody talking about the Browning-Ferris decision. But it really revolves around the concept of control. The rule that's been in existence for at least the last 30 years or so has been that in order for an employer to be found as an employer of an employee, there has to be direct control over at least some terms and conditions of employment, such as hire and fire. And what the new standard is, and what the board has adopted in reversing expressly certain prior decisions, is saying that there doesn't have to be direct and immediate control in order for there to be an employer, that the control can be indirect, the control can even be potential, so that even if the secondary employer has not demonstrated any actual control of terms and conditions of employment, if at least that control is something that could be exercised, even though it has not been exercised, that appears to be enough in order to establish the joint employment relationship. So what does that mean? Well, in this particular case, there was a user-supplier relationship. The supplier was a temporary agency, and the board took a look at different facts and said, well, the user here has exercised some direct control. The dissent disagrees with that, but makes pretty clear that there's actual control that could be exercised, such as in the agreement between the user and the supplier, the user said, we reserve the right to reject any applicant that the supplier wants to hire for working at our location. And even though the user never exercised the right by saying, we don't want you to hire Mikey, who you just hired or made an offer to, the fact that the user had that right, even though unexercised, that creates this joint employer relationship. There's issues with respect to contractor and subcontractor on a job site. There's a Supreme Court decision from years ago that makes pretty clear that the general contractor is not a joint employer with the subs, but clearly a general contractor job site has not only indirect but potential control of different terms and conditions of a subcontractor. So, for example, if an employee of the subcontractor is walking around on a job site drunk, and the general counsel sees that, and the general counsel goes to the subcontractor and says, fire Mikey because he's drunk, I smelled his breath. Even if the general contractor has never done that, that suggests, under the majority's interpretation, that there's this potential control. You have the same kinds of problems with parents and subsidiaries. You've got the same kinds of problems, especially with respect to franchising. And you also have the problems with respect to supply chains, which has not been discussed very much. As a matter of fact, some companies, as part of their corporate culture, as part of their branding, as part of their public relations efforts, go out of their way to tell the entire world that they send in teams to go in and check on their suppliers to make sure that they're adhering to child labor laws and safety rules and regulations and minimum wages and what have you. That clearly is potentially actual control. Now, there's a whole list of practical problems that we can get into with respect to representation cases and unfair labor practice cases and the like, but maybe we'll leave those for our discussions. And then what do you do about it? Well, I think right now everybody is kind of digesting, and every group in the world wants to have a webinar for their members or their clients, and we're getting besieged. I mean, I've done this for 40 years. And aside from EFCA, the Employer Free Choice Act, which obviously never did become law, I have never seen, including the ambush election rule, I've never seen a decision from the Labor Board generate the type of interest that we're getting. And one question that organizations are going to have to ask is that if the Labor Board is going to find that I have control even if I don't exercise it, and I'm going to have the responsibility and the liability that comes from that, should I assume the control, which could go a long way, for example, in destroying the franchise industry? Or do I say I want to make sure that I have not only no actual control, no direct control, no indirect control, I have no control over anything? Well, if you have no control over anything, then how are you going to maintain your brand? And that will give rise to questions such as, do we not contract out? Do we bring it in-house? Do we take responsibility for our own janitorial services, since we don't want to get in bed with another one, our own food service or landscapers or whatever the case may happen to be? And then the last point that I would make is everybody wants to know about appeals. As I said to you, this arises in a representation setting. You cannot directly appeal a representation case decision from the Labor Board. You can only appeal into the courts an unfair labor practice case. There was an election that was held in this case. The ballots have been impounded subject to the Labor Board's decision. It's my understanding that those ballots are going to get counted on Friday. Obviously, we don't know the results of that ballot count, but assuming that the union wins the election, then the union has the right to demand bargaining. The union would make a bargaining request of, in this particular case, the two employers. The two employers bargain. Well, that's the end of the case. There's nothing to appeal. They've accepted the decision. The employers say, we're not going to bargain. That gives rise to an unfair labor practice, refuses to bargain. There's a summary judgment proceeding that goes before the Labor Board. The Labor Board finds them guilty because the employer admits that they refused to bargain. Their defense is that the underlying decision was incorrect. That unfair labor practice then gets appealed into the courts. That is a time-consuming process. It may not happen at all, because who knows what's going to happen with the outcome of the election count. Who knows what's going to happen with respect to agreeing or refusing to bargain. But there are other things that will happen here, and then I promise to stop. I mean, Senator Alexander has said that he will introduce legislation in order to overturn this. Chairman Klein of the House Ed and Workforce Committee has condemned the decision. There's already legislation pending in the House. I think there'll be hearings about this. There's an appropriation strategy. So this is a big deal. So with that as an opening, Dean, I'll pause or stop.
Well, thank you very much. Let's turn to the audience for their questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Mr. Letito, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we're waiting to see who might ring in with a question, let me make a quick announcement, and that is that the dates of our National Lawyers Convention have been announced. This is not breaking news, but there might be some new folks on the line that we want to get this information to. The convention this year in Washington, D.C., as always, will be November 12th through the 14th. That's Thursday, November 12th. Through Saturday, November 14th, here in Washington, D.C. Today, of course, we're speaking with Michael Letito. He's of the Littler Mendelson Law Firm. We've opened the floor to questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending, so let's take our first call of the day.
Michael, John Rodabaugh, thank you so much for your discussion on this critical issue. Obviously, the nature of the employer in question that would be, as it were, sucked into the situation is different from one industry to another. But what could be done in, let's say, in the facts of this particular case? What could Browning Ferris have done to structure the relationship and in its contract with LeadPoint to at least minimize or circumvent what was found to justify a joint employer finding? Are there certain contract provisions and other things that could be done to protect them?
John, thanks very much for participating, and thanks for your question. It's always an honor to speak to a former member of the Labor Board that's asking humble me for my interpretation, so I appreciate that. You know, in looking at the case, there's a list, I think, beginning on about page 18 through around 21 of the majority opinion that discusses the kind of control that BFI allegedly exercised. And I'm going to state these facts not as facts necessarily, but rather as quote-unquote findings, because the dissent disagrees with some of these findings. But what the majority said is that BFI exercised control with respect to hiring, because they said that anybody who's hired has to meet or exceed BFI standards. So I guess if BFI said, we have no standards, you can hire anybody that you want to, that would help, quote unquote. BFI, according to the board, said that we require the supplier employees to pass a drug test. Don't want anybody passing any drug tests here. So we don't really care whether you have individuals that are impaired. They can come onto the property. We don't care about the drug tests. And if one of our people get injured, so be it, because we don't want to be a joint employer. There were these provisions apparently in the agreement that said that if the supplier attempted to rehire a former BFI employee, that BFI reserved the right to say to the supplier, either don't hire him in the first place, or if you did, get rid of him. And then there was this right that I talked about earlier about the ability of the user to reject an applicant. So that was the hiring area. Then there was the controls of the terms and conditions of employment. There was an incident, as described in the opinion, where BFI asked for a couple of people to be dismissed, and a BFI executive had seen two individuals who were passing a flask of alcohol or something to that effect between the two of them, and a memo got generated that said, fire these guys, and the board majority looked to this and said, see, here's an example, that if you read the decision very carefully, as I know you have, John, it says in there someplace that actually the supplier did not follow the direction of BFI in that case, because they only fired one of the two individuals, the other one they transferred. But that apparently, you know, gave rise to this control.
If you structured it in such a way that it was just totally, totally hands off by BFI, then you're still left with that issue of pricing. How do you go about determining the price of the subcontract, or do you or should BFI have it reopened every month or something so that they indirectly have a way of pricing the contract without finding BFI setting wage rates?
That's right. That was one of the issues, because this was a cost-plus contract. Now, the majority says
right.
The cost-plus contract in and of itself is not enough to create your own employer. But in this case, let's assume there was none of these other controls and there were a few quote-unquote others. There was one incident. I guess the plant was in San Jose, so at some point during the contract, San Jose increased the minimum wage. Obviously, cities, counties all around the country are engaged in increasing minimum wage. So that precipitated a contract renewal and a change in terms. Does that mean that the quote-unquote actual employer in this case is the user? Because the user has now agreed to give the supplier quote-unquote more money under the contract, so the supplier can quote-unquote pay its employees more money. And does that in and of itself mean that there's now a joint employment relationship, so that even if all of these other things didn't exist, it didn't matter, because that one factor in and of itself is going to be enough, which is why I said earlier, people are going to have to, or organizations are going to have to ask and answer the following question. If I'm going to be found to be a joint employer, even if that's all I do, then if I'm going to have the responsibility as if I exercise the control, maybe I ought to go ahead and exercise the control.
Right, right. Well, perhaps the solution to this is, Michael, that we should put you on the board.
Well, no, John, you can go back onto the board, or Roger King can go onto the board. But something called the November 16 elections are going to have something to say about whoever gets on the board.
Let's hope so. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Well, appreciate it.
And this is Dean Reuter. Before you go, John Rodabaugh, let me turn the tables on you and ask you a question, if I may, since you're a former board member and we only have one question pending. It seems implicit from the tone of your question that you think this rule is just as momentous as Mr. Letito does. Is that correct, or do you want to say more about that, the impact of this rule in your sense?
I think it is beyond anything either one of us could ever imagine. I think it upends business modeling. It's so overwhelming to me that I can't imagine how an administrative agency would be able to do something like this. It brings us back again and again and again to where, and not surprising to anyone, the Congress that we're left with, perhaps across our entire lifetimes, have just abdicated on adjusting labor law to different conditions and leaving it up to administrative agencies that, as Michael implied, whether it's a Democrat majority or a Republican majority, certainly in the last decade or two, has done nothing but be politicized. So, no, I think this decision is as fundamental as any in my lifetime.
We've got a question pending, and we also have a question I've received by email. Let me check in with this emailer who's asking, does it matter that federal law compels the employer to impose certain employment requirements on the contractor? That's a question for Mr. Letito, of course.
I think that's an excellent, excellent question. And, of course, I would argue that since all the parties are doing is complying with another provision of federal law, that shouldn't be, quote-unquote, held against them. This majority, there's no question in my mind, and John could comment if he wants, but there's no question in my mind that this particular majority could care less. This majority had a philosophical approach, which was what I articulated in my opening comments, and they had a preordained idea as to what they wanted to accomplish, and they will accomplish it no matter how they have to go about it. And I think that they would ignore that as a factor, and they would say it doesn't make any difference why the control is there. What really only matters is that the control is there.
And as Michael said, and I think to show how this is so incredibly overwhelming, is this is a coordinated effort across agencies, as Michael noted. We see exactly the same thing going on through Wage and Hour, and we'll see it across other agencies. It's been an orchestrated effort with a former senior official of the NLRB who's now reporting directly to the Secretary of Labor to help coordinate this structured approach.
And in fact, to John's point, last week the IFA submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to OSHA because a couple of days before Browning-Ferris came out, we came in possession, when I say we, the IFA, and I'm counsel to the IFA, came into possession of an internal document by the Solicitor of Labor, which was about 5 or 7 pages of questions that the OSHA investigator was supposed to be asking the franchisee in order to determine whether or not there was joint liability with the franchisor. And if you read that document and the questions that were being asked, it's as if they had Browning-Ferris before the rest of us had Browning-Ferris. So this is not just an NLRB issue, which is why I go back to David Weil and the Fissured Workplace and his book as the Bible, the intellectual foundation for what Wage and Hour is doing, for what OSHA is doing, for what the Labor Board is doing. And I think that people make a mistake if they look at this decision too narrowly. As important as this decision is, as dramatic as this decision is, it has to be seen within a greater drama that's been playing out over the last 6.5, 7 years.
And does this then effectively make every employer does this make every federal contractor a joint employer of its subcontractors' employees?
Well, I don't know about every, because you'd still have to look at the control, but I can tell you that we just filed comments last week on the blacklisting rule with respect to the federal government contractors. You talk about an overreach, and the blacklisting rule has sometimes been called the blackmail rule, because I guarantee you that one of the things that organized labor is going to do from a leverage perspective with respect to federal government contractors is make all kinds of allegations about joint employment with respect to the subcontractors in order to create a record against the sub as well as the prime that neither are going to be happy about with respect to the labor compliance officials that are going to be reporting to the contracting officials in order to determine whether or not you even get the contract. So there's mischief here that is beyond mischievous.
I want to get to our next caller who's been waiting patiently. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got 2 questions pending, then our lines are open. Push the star button, then the pound button. Let's now go to our next caller.
Hi, good morning. This is Bob Zadik. I am not a labor attorney. My practice is one where I represent commercial lenders and factoring companies who provide extensive credit to staffing companies secured by the receivables owed to the staffing companies by the employer, what I'll call the ultimate employer. So I'm not a labor lawyer. The of great concern to my clients, the lenders, is the integrity and the collectability of the accounts. And they worry to death about a staffing company which, for whatever reason, doesn't pay its employees. The employees descend upon the ultimate employer and say, we didn't get paid by the staffing company, so give us the money. The employers invariably will pay the employees under fear of dual employee liability and simply offset it against the receivable. So in effect, when the staffing company fails, my clients have no collateral because the accounts have been offset by payment to the workers. So the issue of when the ultimate employer is liable for the unpaid wages is a very big deal. It seems to me, as I observe this decision and hear this commentary, that this decision imposes now upon lenders, the staffing companies, incredible burdens of due diligence, and am I correct in that? And is there now a greater risk in lending to staffing companies?
Well, thanks very much for your question. I think that, yes, there's definitely a greater risk. And your question is so terrific because it demonstrates just how potentially far-reaching this decision is. And the dissent, back on page 37, talks about contractual relationships being potentially encompassed. In their very first bullet is the following, which you'll find of interest. Insurance companies that require employers to take certain actions with employees in order to comply with policy requirements for safety, security, health, etc. The majority criticizes the dissent in its discussion about all of these different possibilities by saying that, well, we're not dealing with any of these facts. This is an evolutionary process. We'll do fact-by-fact determination. And all the dissent is doing is creating a law school type of question and answer with respect to their dissent that's totally unnecessary because the sky is not going to fall. Well, with all due respect to the majority, it is the majority that has answered a law school question based upon technical readings of the restatement of agency, which gives zero guidance from a practical perspective to businesses such as the one you represent, such as an industry that you represent. And the dissent is highly critical, and I think correctly so, of the majority opinion by saying that a governmental agency like the Labor Board has a responsibility to provide certainty with respect to business relationships so that individuals know what's expected of them. And they cite Supreme Court authority for those propositions. Clearly, the majority decision does not do that. So yes, it increases risk. Does that mean that there needs to be some sort of an evaluation of that risk? The answer is yes. We have a call scheduled later this week internally with private equity companies. Private equity companies, you know, give money to organizations. They don't particularly want to run a hotel that they've invested in. But do they have the ultimate responsibility? You see where these arguments go. So thanks very much for your question.
And I would just, as a follow-up, if I may, the due diligence imposed upon lenders for staffing companies would be now to aggressively make sure that the wages are paid by the staffing company so as not to impair the collectability of the receivable for the bill for the staffing services, something which lenders often do but not always do. This may change an often to an always in terms of due diligence.
And I would also say this, there's a catch-22. Catch-22 is perhaps the more due diligence that the lender does of the client, that perhaps the more likelihood that you're going to find that there was joint employer, because why are they doing all of the due diligence? Because the due diligence may not only be upfront, but maybe the lender now creates a five-person group within the lending organization that goes out from time to time and conducts audits of their insureds in order to make sure that the requirements that were part of the due diligence are actually being followed. And if you aren't following them, we provide some guidance and assistance as to how you can follow them. I mean,
which happens, by the way, is now to the lender, there's an additional cost of that lending to that industry, which cost is ultimately passed along to the ultimate employer. So now some due diligence imposed by labor law is now going to be borne by society, as lenders have to now do things they ordinarily would not always do just because they don't want to get nailed by having their receivables offset.
And just to follow it, the majority says that this is all hypothetical. Well, it's not hypothetical. in, along the lines of what we're talking about. The Department of Labor wants to change the overtime requirements. There's a proposed rule. The comments are due this Friday, the 4th. They want to raise the overtime requirement to a minimum of $50,400. There's a variety of other things that are not germane to this call, but this is germane. When that rule is final and the Department of Labor says, here's our new basis for determining salary basis for overtime, and the lender says to all of its insureds, guess what? We're going to have a webinar for you. We're going to have some form policies. We're going to have some checklists for you to make sure that you're in compliance with this new rule. Well, does that mean you're a joint employer? Because you're giving them guidance with respect to what the new rule from the Department of Labor has just announced with respect to overtime, which will impact every single workplace in the United States? This is not a hypothetical discussion. The majority is disingenuous. And I would say this, John Ratabow, to Mark's face and to any of the others' face, they are disingenuous by saying that this is just something that people are saying the sky is falling. No, it's coming down.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've still got two callers with questions, so let's carry on.
Mike, this is Bill Emanuel at Littler. Regarding the private equity question you raised, is there a risk, like if a private equity company said to one of its portfolio companies that the payroll is too high and they have to cut wages or cut staff in order to meet their projections? Is there a risk that this joint employer concept would apply in that situation?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, Bill, I think that also from a leverage perspective, the way that this would be used is, as you well know, some of the union corporate campaigns that take place, they focus in on the equity company. You can rest assured that what's going to happen is that the unfair labor practice and the other claims are going to go not only against the principal company, but also against the private equity company. The private equity company is going to say, what the heck is this? I give you X number of millions of dollars in order to get a claim that I'm a joint employer with you when I don't know anything about your employees. I don't even know any of their names. Yeah, but when you came in, you told us that if this was going to be a successful venture, we were going to have to reduce unit labor costs by 10%. That was a condition of us getting the money.
Right.
Guess who the employer is?
Right. I have another question. In the franchise industry, which you alluded to already, how do you foresee the unions trying to exploit this in practical terms?
Well, of course, the unions are already exploiting it, and the general counsel, for those that are not the labor lawyers, has filed a massive number of complaints with respect to McDonald's. That case is supposed to resume on October the 6th. It probably won't because of discovery disputes. The point is that the leverage that the SEIU and the support of these union front organizations have already gotten a great win because the general counsel in his complaint against McDonald's says that under the quote-unquote old test now that the labor board has of direct control, McDonald's has a liability, but I'm going to argue in the alternative. What's the alternative? The alternative is now based upon Browning-Ferris. And so I think that the exploitation has already begun, and really began with the general counsel's amicus brief in the Browning-Ferris case. And I think that among the happiest people this Labor Day, aside from Rich Trumka and others in organized labor, have got to be Richard Griffin, the general counsel of the labor board, because he just made his case against McDonald's that much easier. So I think what's going to happen is that you're going to see a continued proliferation of the unfair labor practices being filed against the franchisees. The franchisors are going to be named as joint employers. And then what's going to happen is that organized labor is going to make their request against the franchisor for neutrality and card check. As a matter of fact, there's an article in today's Guardian where labor officials are talking about Fight for 15. They specifically talk about McDonald's, how they're not going to stop, how they want to get McDonald's to sit down. Well, what do they want? They want a neutrality and card check agreement that McDonald's enters into in order to make it easier for the union to be able to organize all of the employees. Is that just going to extend to the McDonald's corporate-owned stores? Well, if McDonald's is found to be a joint employer with respect to all of its franchises, does that then extend to all of the franchises? Well, presumably it does, because then all of the franchise employees, according to the labor board, are jointly employed by the franchisor, by McDonald's. So therefore, the neutrality and card check agreement presumably extends to everybody. So under those circumstances, organized labor gets a return on investment, because McDonald's employs about 750,000 employees throughout their network in the United States with about a 50 or 60% turnover. And what are you looking at? That's the end game here. Understand that this is not, and I know that you do, Bill, understand that this is not about joint employer. This is not about some legal discussion that, you know, the lawyers love to have. This is about increasing union market share. And I've been doing it for 40 years, and every year in that 40-year period of time, union market share at best, has stayed even. It's gone from 25% to about 6.5% in my 40 years. It's gone from 35% down to the 6.5% from 1955. So at the end of the day, this is about increasing leverage for organized labor to gain more members. It's not some academic discussion that law school professors want to have in order to figure out how many actual controls that have never been exercised can we place on the head of a pin. It's about increasing market share.
So if the labor board is
enabling them to do that.
If a franchisor like McDonald's signs a neutrality card check agreement, then that could bind the small business owner who owns a franchise somewhere anywhere in the U.S. Is that correct?
I sure think that that's the position that the SEIU would take, because they would say that they're all your employees. Now, the franchisees will fight back and say, well, you can't do that under our franchise agreement, because you're in breach of the franchise agreement, because the franchise agreement says that I'm responsible for my own employees. And after 10 years of litigation, we'll figure out who's right.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got but one question pending. We've still got about 15 minutes or so. So if you'd like to ask a question, I think we'll have time. Let's take another call now.
Yeah, hi. This is Jim Bowen. I'm not a labor lawyer. My understanding procedurally is that the next step is that if BFI California were to appeal, their appeal would be to the Ninth Circuit, where existing precedent on labor employment relationships or employer employee relationships would apply. And of course, Supreme Court would be beyond that, and Supreme Court precedent would apply. Do I have that procedural step correct? Thanks.
Well, if thanks for your question. If again, there's a refusal to bargain and you go through all of these other steps, you can always appeal in the D.C. Circuit because that's where the labor board is. Whether you want to or not is a whole separate discussion. They obviously could appeal into the Ninth. There's certainly some interesting decisions, even by the California Supreme Court, last year in the Domino's case, which arose under the Department of Fair Employment and Housing rules from the country of California, that found there was no joint employment relationship because there was no direct control. Now, obviously, making a determination of joint employment under the NLRA is different than it would be under California Supreme Court interpretation of the DFVH. But, you know, even in California, even the California Supreme Court has said that you need direct control. So even though you're in the Ninth Circuit, that may not be the worst place in the world, but ultimately, this has to go to the Supremes. It makes the 2016 elections that much more important, because if we continue down the same philosophical path we've been on, And you get a change in the Supreme Court, just like we've now had a change in the D.C. Circuit, and you have a continuation of people that share the philosophical views of the majority of this labor board, and that goes on for another 4 or 8 years, we have some very, very significant disruption with respect to who an employer is.
We do have another question. We've got time probably for 2 more questions at least, so if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's move forward.
Thank you for a great presentation. This is Roger Candelari, and my question goes not only to our main speaker today, but I wonder if Dean Reuter would comment on this. It seems to me what you're telling us, I'm not a specialist at all in labor law, is another example of a very aggressive overreaching by this administration. The one I'm most familiar with has been the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education, when it arbitrarily, and I think without warrant, imposed a whole lot of new rules on 1,800 universities that receive, universities and colleges that receive federal funding with respect to sexual harassment. And it seems to me there's probably a pattern that if you look at all of the teleforms and other presentations by the Federalist Society, we've seen this throughout the administration in field after field after field. Is that perception correct? And what fields have there been similar kind of overreaches?
Well, Mr. Letito, this is Dean Reuter. Do you want to respond first?
Dean, all I can say is that, generally speaking, I absolutely agree with the questioner, but I don't have the expertise, certainly, to comment on the educational initiative, et cetera, so I defer to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Candelari, for your question. I can respond just by pointing folks to our large catalog of teleform conference calls, which have been recorded and which are available as podcasts on the Federalist Society's website. That's one way to respond. I would generally agree that there's a lot going on in the administrative state. And I run, for the Federalist Society, 15 different practice groups covering all areas of law, administrative law, but also civil rights, telecommunications, labor and employment, you name it, we cover it. And each one of those practice groups is headed by a volunteer board of our members, and each one of those boards thinks that their corollary agencies, that is the agency that's responsible for their area of law, whether it's the FCC or the EPA or the SEC or the NLRB, EEOC, or any other agency, they all are convinced that their corresponding agencies are the great comes to executive branch overreach. So I don't answer the question as directly as pointing you to the to what I hear from our members, that every agency seemingly is going beyond its bounds. Does that answer your question, Roger?
Yes, really, that's a good way to approach it. And I think there are, as our speaker said, huge political implications for this, that somehow we need to change the direction and return to something that resembles rule of law and some modicum of constitutionality. As the speaker was speaking, I was thinking, where is the constitutional warrant for this BFI decision? And I strain to find.
Always a good question, though. It looks like we do have another question from our audience.
Yeah, this is Bill Emanuel again. Mike, I know you're very active on the Washington D.C. legal scene, so you may have some insights on this. But is there any possibility of relief from Congress on this extreme decision, like cutting off funding or something of that nature? Obviously, they're not going to pass legislation, or I wouldn't think that would get past the White House. But is there something else that can be done in an extreme situation like this?
Well, there is an appropriation strategy, Bill, without giving too much away. Certainly the IFA and others have been very active in educating members of Congress on this whole joint employer issue and the threat in particular that it has to the franchise industry. As a matter of fact, there were two field hearings last week, one in Savannah and one in Mobile, dealing with the issue, one of which took place a couple of hours before Browning Ferris was actually issued. And part of that education has been to prepare those members of Congress for the possibility of defunding the labor board with respect to this type of an initiative. Unfortunately, the labor appropriations bill is not going to be a standalone bill. It's going to be an amalgamation. You know, when we're talking about the Congress going back, and one of the big issues, again, is whether the government's going to be shut down, is it going to be enough money, you know, is this issue going to be enough to stop the federal budget from going forward? And they have to deal in increasing the debt load, which is now about $18 trillion come November. I think you can pretty much figure out what the answer to that is. I mean, well, this is hugely important. Issues such as Iran and the deficit, et cetera, are all a heck of a lot more important, in my view, than this. But that's not to say that there isn't this effort and that there isn't a lot of education, and that whether there's the R side or the D side, a lot of legislators that have been spoken to have expressed a lot of surprise, and part of their reaction is, well, it hasn't happened yet. It's happened. And there are a lot of people that were hoping that it would never happen. And with all due respect, hope is not a plan. So the next effort, in addition to appropriations, is legislation. And as you know, Bill, both the House and the Senate did vote to overcome the Labor Board's quickie election rule. That got vetoed by the White House. One of the four vetoes that the president has exercised during his entire term in office was to veto a piece of legislation that was going to rein in the Labor Board. So the likelihood of the Congress being successful in getting something that the president would sign is pretty remote. But that, again, raises the issue about what do you do about 2016, because in my view, you can get into a great discussion for law review purposes about who is and who is not a joint employer. But fundamentally, this labor board decision is a decision about social policy. That means it's really a politically motivated decision based upon strongly held beliefs that I happen to disagree with. And if you're going to ultimately change the direction of a politically motivated decision, you will have to do that by changing the politics behind it.
Right.
Well,
thanks.
And as a closing remark, it looks like we've exhausted the audience questions here, but let me, since we have a couple minutes left, revert to you to see if you do have any final thoughts before we adjourn.
That's to me, Dean?
Yes.
Well, I would just like to thank everyone for their participation. I think that this is an extremely serious, serious problem that has to be seen within the broader context that I think our discussion has illustrated today. And from the practitioner's perspective of trying to figure out what it is that we're going to tell our clients, whether it's a private equity firm, whether it's an insurance company, whether it's a franchisee, whether it's a franchisor, whether it's a company concerned about their supply chain, whether it's a temp agency, whether it's a user of a temp agency, whether it's a general contractor or a subcontractor on a job site. All of these organizations are going to need guidance, and I got to tell you, it's a real struggle. As a matter of fact, when my wife said to me the other day that she had some concerns because we've got some construction going on to remodel our kitchen, you've all been through that, that she didn't like one of the workers and she really wanted to tell the contractor to get that worker out of here, I said to her, don't do it. I didn't want to be a joint employer. Where this goes, anybody knows.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mr. an issue of moment, and it's been impressed upon our audience as such. To the audience, let me remind you to check our website for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.